Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back to my channel for another episode of my history series, where today I want to share with you the story of the Tokaimura criticality accident, which in turn caused the most radioactive man in history. This was the most serious nuclear accident that Japan has ever seen and was classified at the time as a serious criticality accident, an accidental, uncontrolled nuclear fission chain reaction. As a result of this, 667 people were exposed to radiation and two people sadly died. But Tokaimura wasn't a nuclear reactor or a power plant, it was a fuel processing plant, which in ways is even more hazardous than the former options. I'm definitely coming down with a bit of a cold. This is my first cold since before the pandemic, so if I sound a bit chesty or a bit nasally, that's why. I'm really sorry, I hope it's not too annoying. This is literally the worst week I could possibly have got ill, so of course this is the week that happened to me, but gotta soldier on, I've gotta work through it. I've spent a long time reading about this accident and trying to figure out all of the sciencey details of it, but the truth is my brain just doesn't work like that, and I'm sure a lot of yours don't either. So my description of how this accident came to happen is going to be somewhat of a dummy's version. I feel like that's the easiest way to get it across. So our story begins at a small fuel preparation plant in Tokai, Ibaraki Prefecture in Japan, about 70 miles northwest of Tokyo. The plant was operated by a company called JCO, and it was basically just various specialised research and experimental reactors. This was not used to produce electricity for the public. This plant was commissioned in 1988 and processed up to 3 tonnes of uranium every year. And this is where things get a bit sciencey. The nuclear fuel preparation procedure at this particular plant involved dissolving uranium oxide powder in nitric acid in a dissolution tank. Then the solution would be transferred to a storage column for mixing before going into a precipitation tank that was surrounded by cold water to remove any excess heat produced by the chemical reaction. At least, this is how the process had been designed to go. It went through strict general licensing requirements, as you would expect. It was very important to ensure that everything worked perfectly in this process to ensure that no criticality accidents would happen. However, 3 years prior to 1999, the procedure was modified without permission from the right authorities. The uranium oxide was now dissolved in stainless steel buckets rather than the dissolution tank, and was then modified further to speed up the process. You know things are going to go wrong when proper scientific tanks are being replaced with buckets. The solution would then be tipped directly from the buckets into the precipitation tank. This new process entirely bypassed the storage tank, where it remixed according to the right controls and instead was mechanically stirred in the precipitation tank. This also meant that there was no proper control as to how much was tipped into the tank. As you can imagine, I'm sure, when working with nuclear materials, everything has to be measured down to the letter. There's no room for mistakes here. But this simply wasn't happening at Tokaimura in 1999. On the 30th of September 1999, three workers, Hisashi Aouchi, Masato Shinohara, and Yutaka Yokokawa, were on a tight deadline. They needed to meet upcoming shipping requirements. That day, they were working on a reactor that hadn't been used in 3 years, and it would later turn out that the workers had no proper qualifications or training requirements to prepare them for this particular job. They had previously used this same procedure though many times, they've been doing this job for a long time. This was entirely different from your standard uranium, and the workers poured it directly into the precipitation tank, bypassing all the equipment in place that was supposed to avoid criticality. You may have noticed I have a really hard time saying precipitation. Precipitation is hard. At around 10:35 a.m, the volume of the solution in this tank reached about 14 litres and contained 16 kilograms of uranium. A critical mass had been reached. There shouldn't have been that much. At this point of criticality, a nuclear fission chain reaction started, emitting intense gamma and neutron radiation, triggering alarms inside the building and also emitting a distinctive blue glow. There was no explosion, nothing visually dramatic, but radiation was being released inside the building at an alarming rate. The container wasn't destroyed by the reaction, and because of this it became a crude sort of nuclear reactor without all of the added bits to stop a criticality incident like this happening. And because the uranium was in a solution of water which just expedited the reaction, the criticality event proved difficult to stop. It would continue intermittently for about 20 hours. Every time the solution cooled down, the chemical reaction would just start again, and it didn't stop until the cooling water around the tank was drained away. It was said to have completely stopped by 5:30 p.m. the following day. Of course, it took so long to put an end to it because no one could get near the reactor. They couldn't re-enter the building because they were concerned about being exposed to radiation. Whilst most chain reactions will just blow themselves out pretty quickly, this just wasn't the case at Tokamura. Once they did enter to end it, boron was also injected into the tank to absorb the neutrons at this point, just in case, an extra precaution. The workers in the room, Aochi, Shinohara and Yokokawa, were the worst affected by the radiation. The unit used to measure radiation absorbent is something called a sievert, and although sources differ on exact numbers, it seems anything over 7 sievert of radiation received over a very short period of time is said to be a lethal dose. 35-year-old Hisashi Aochi was said to receive 17 sievert, having been bent over the container at the time the reaction started. 39-year-old Masato Shinohara received 10, and their supervisor, 54-year-old Yutaki Yokokawa, who was either in an adjacent room or at a desk the other side of the room, received just 3 sieverts. For context, Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors were exposed to 0.5 sieverts, and the emergency workers who attended the aftermath of Chernobyl were exposed to 0.25. The workers noted seeing the blue glow coming from the container and then almost immediately started feeling the effects of radiation, pain, nausea and difficulty breathing. Aochi, who received the largest dose, started to have problems with mobility, coherence and loss of consciousness. He passed out for about 70 minutes once he'd left the room. The alarm told them that they needed to escape immediately, but they weren't aware of the impact the accident would have on everyone in the vicinity straight away. It wasn't until a worker in the next building over became aware of what had happened and contacted emergency services, where the workers even escorted to the closest hospital. It took 40 minutes for Japan's Science and Technology Agency, who deal with events like this, to be told what was going on, and then 18 more minutes for the Ibaraki prefecture to be warned, and nearly 2 hours before the Prime Minister was told. This was bad enough that it needed to go up to the Prime Minister. In the next few hours, 49 people went under medical observation for exposure to radiation. The 3 staff I've already mentioned, 36 staff who were in the vicinity but less affected, as well as 10 non-staff, including the 3 firemen who had to rescue the 3 seriously exposed workers, and construction workers who were on scaffolding on the outskirts of the plant. 2 hours after the incident, immediate neighbours were indicated that there had been an incident, when police blocked roads and banned entry within a 200 metre radius of the plant. Almost 4.5 hours after the incident, evacuation commenced of 161 people from 39 different houses in a 350 metre radius from the conversion building. They were allowed home 2 days later after steps had been taken to ensure there were no more hazards. 12 hours after the start of the incident, all residents within the 10-kilometre radius were asked to stay indoors and schools were closed, but that was lifted the following afternoon. That was about 310,000 people asked to remain inside. 24 workers who were involved in the operation to stop the incident were also exposed, obviously. Over the next 10 days, about 10,000 medical checkups were conducted in the region, just making sure that people were okay. Radiation levels outside the plant skyrocketed, with levels peaking at 20,000 times higher than normal. According to the Irish Times, these numbers were so high that a person standing outdoors 2 kilometres away would receive more radiation in 1 hour than they would usually be exposed to in a whole year. It was a dangerous situation for anyone in the vicinity. It was also raining at the time, and residents were told to ensure that they wiped their feet dry before entering their homes and removed any wet clothes, with fears that they would bring the radiation inside their homes. Farmers were told to abandon their harvest, and for the following few days, people were terrified to eat anything. The Prime Minister actually ended up visiting Tokaimura, and on his visit, he ate local vegetables and local fish to prove that they were safe to eat. You can understand the concern from the locals though, I'm sure. Essentially, after the criticality was terminated and extra shielding was put in place around the building in question, radiation levels beyond the plant site returned to normal pretty quickly. It seems that originally the 3 most affected men were taken to the local National Mito Hospital before being very quickly transferred over to the National Institute of Radiological Sciences in Chiba, just east of Tokyo. Testing there showed that Aochi and Shinohara's lymphatic blood count was basically non-existent and had plunged right down to 0. On the 2nd of October, Aochi was transferred to the hospital of the University of Tokyo, and 2 days later, Shinohara was transferred to the hospital of the Institute of Medical Sciences of the University of Tokyo. Lots of different hospitals. Yokokawa, however, remained at the National Institute of Radiological Sciences. His exposure was much less severe than that of his co-workers. He was pretty much fine. The others, as you guessed, weren't so lucky. It quickly became clear that Aochi was going to become seriously ill as a result of irradiation. There's really not much you can do to reverse the effects of a large dose like this. When you Google this case and Aochi's name, you come across a pretty horrific photo of a man lying in a hospital bed, which is often said to be Aochi himself. From what I've been able to gather, whilst the photo is of a real person, it is not him. I wouldn't recommend you go looking for it, but it is a common misconception that it is a photo of him, but it was just not. However, he was still in a very, very bad way. Due to his non-existent lymphatic blood cell count, a blood stem cell transplant was pretty much his only option, and luckily his sister was a match. For the next 16 days, he was said to be in a critical condition, and despite the transplant, his prognosis was still poor. Shinohara had received slightly less radiation and was reported to start vomiting 1 hour after the exposure. When he arrived at the hospital, he was alert and his general condition was said to be good, although his skin was red. As I said, he also had a significantly reduced lymphatic blood cell count and his bone marrow was severely damaged, so a stem cell transplant was also planned for him, except no donor matches could be found. Instead, he received transplantation of umbilical cord blood cells on the 8th of October. His prognosis was said to be uncertain from this point onwards. Yokokawa, who had the lowest dose of radiation, was said to be pretty much asymptomatic after exposure. Testing did show a moderately reduced lymphatic blood cell count, for which he received bone marrow stimulation, and ultimately he was fine. All in all, he was fine. His prognosis was said to be good from the outset, with full recovery expected, although he would be at hugely increased risk for cancer later in his life. He was released from hospital just 3 months later in the December with minor radiation sickness. But the first couple of months would be rocky for both Aochi and Shinohara. One doctor who had been treating Shinohara in the hospital's intensive care unit said that treating him had made him brutally aware of the limitations of medical science, saying, "I was overwhelmed by a sense of helplessness in the face of something caused by human arrogance." Shinohara did eventually show signs of improvement after skin grafts, radical cancer treatment, and the umbilical cord blood transfusion that I mentioned previously. On New Year's Day 2000, he was even well enough to be taken out to hospital's garden in his wheelchair. But after this point, his condition began to deteriorate again. From February, he was on a respirator, and on April 10th, he was transferred to the University of Tokyo Hospital for what I assume was more specialised care. However, in mid-April, he began to deteriorate rapidly again, with his respiratory and kidney functions beginning to fail. Shinohara died on the 27th of April 2000 of multiple organ failure, leaving behind his wife and three children. And sadly, he hadn't been the first one of the workers to die. Shinohara's journey had been a lot easier than that of his colleagues, Hisashi Auchi, and that's saying something. Hisashi Auchi is most often referred to as the world's most radioactive man, and somehow he was kept alive for 83 whole days. 83 days filled with nothing but pain and suffering. It's believed that the 17 sieverts of radiation that he absorbed was the highest level that any living human had ever been exposed to. It would have been a blessing if he had died upon exposure. In the immediate aftermath, as I mentioned previously, Auchi lost consciousness for about 70 minutes. He had severe nausea and diarrhea, and there are reports that he was crying blood, with blood coming from his eyeballs. Regardless, reports say that the doctors originally thought that he looked relatively well for a person exposed to so much radiation. His skin was red like he was sunburnt, and his arm was swollen and hurting, but he didn't look like what you'd imagine. He was alert and chatting, and some nurses thought that he might have even been able to go home that day. However, that's not really how radiation poisoning works, and his condition got gradually worse, and eventually the radiation wreaked havoc on his body. The doctors didn't really know what to do with him. There's no precedent for treatment of people who've received 17 sieverts of radiation. It's not something that really happens. Immediate test results showed that every chromosome in his body had been decimated by the radiation, leaving them mutated and destroyed. His DNA had literally been ripped apart. There's no going back from that. Really, it was just a waiting game until the effects really started to show. In the days following the accident, as I said, his lymphatic blood count fell to nothing and he had to receive the blood stem cell transplant. But this also meant that his immune system fell to nothing. He had no protection against any of the germs that we come across every day. And when you're in a hospital setting, that becomes even more dangerous because there's all kinds of germs in hospitals. Of course, Auchi was kept in an isolated intensive care room, and ultimately the treatment would work to begin with. His white blood cell count did start to rise, but it wouldn't be enough. Eventually, even his sister's healthy blood cells would begin to be affected by the radiation. They would be destroyed. And soon the effects of the radiation started to show outwardly as his skin began to slough off his body. Thanks to the destroyed chromosomes, his body was no longer able to create new skin cells to replace the old, and skin grafts with lab-cultured skin would just fail, they would just fall off. With no skin, fluid would leak through what was left, and he needed constant IVs to replace it. Fluid started to build up in his lungs, and although doctors wanted to put him on a respirator, they wanted to give him time to talk to his wife. They didn't want to take their last communications away. This was short-lived though, soon they had no other choice. His family were allowed to visit every day, with doctors saying that the only reason they'd been allowed in so much was so they could see the effect the radiation was having on his body, the appearance of which was changing by the day, by the hour. His family needed to accept how bad the situation was, but also, so did Auchi. It doesn't seem that he realised all too quickly the condition that his body was in. Asking the nurse if he was now at a higher chance of catching leukemia or something. He didn't realise in those early days that his death was inevitable because he looked fine, he felt fine, and his family could also see that. Each day his family visited, they would fold a paper crane. In Japanese legend, it's said that a person who folds 1,000 paper cranes would be granted one of two things, either a wish or good health and recovery. His family wanted good health and recovery. They refused to let go, and Ouchie just wanted to go home. But it was never going to be, as eventually he started to lose blood at an unbelievable rate. In one singular day, he could receive up to 10 blood transfusions. Nothing would help, no drugs, no treatment. The doctors were just delaying the inevitable, and they knew it. Eventually, all they could do was give him the strongest painkillers they had. But despite this, Ouchie's family begged doctors to do all they could to keep him alive. And the doctors, they have to do what the family says. Eventually, the stress was too much for his heart and it stopped. But the family had refused to sign a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, and therefore the medical team at the hospital was legally bound to do what they could to keep him alive. I'm sure at that point they felt it was cruel to bring him back. He had no skin, he was bleeding internally and externally. I was in more pain than you or I could imagine. He had no DNA, but they had to do it. 3 times on the same day, his heart stopped and was restarted, and eventually it did maintain a steady beat. He was alive against all odds. But now the lack of oxygen to the brain had left him brain damaged as well. He no longer responded when his family called to him. It was only after this point that the family agreed to sign a DNR. 83 days after the exposure to radiation, on the 21st of December 1999, Hisashi Ouchie naturally passed away, his cause of death found to be cardiac arrest. There's a common misconception when it comes to this story that Ouchie was used as something of a guinea pig by the medical staff who wanted to research the effects of radiation on the human body, but that simply wasn't the case. The doctors in this case did what they could within reason to help him survive. They take an oath to act in the patient's best interests, but essentially it was Ouchie and his family's choice that kept him alive as long as he was. I don't think it's right to demonise anyone in this situation. Ouchie's family were faced with a decision that you never want to have to make, and they fought to keep their loved one alive for as long as they could. They didn't understand the effects of radiation. Perhaps it was cruel, but in your grief you don't always think straight. It was love, but it was painful. If you want to blame anyone in this story, then perhaps the company at the plant is to blame. The 3 workers were under a strict time pressure to meet shipping requirements that day. They were untrained and unqualified for the work they were doing and therefore skipped important steps, but that's the way the company did it, that's the way they were told to do it. There was way more uranium in that container than there ever should have been, especially the type of enriched uranium that was being used here. After a lengthy investigation, the cause of the accident was found to be both human error and serious breaches of safety principles. It was found that the company hadn't had any major incidents for over 15 years, and that had made everyone complacent. There had been an incident in 1997 in which 21 workers were exposed to radioactivity after waste was set on fire and there was a small explosion. And management mandated workers to falsely report what happened that day to cover up the fact that the workers weren't properly supervised. And in turn, this had an impact on the 1999 incident. If this small incident in 97 had been followed up and properly, if people had been retrained as a result, then perhaps the damage in 1999 could have been mitigated, or maybe it wouldn't have happened at all. JCO, the company in charge, conceded that it violated both normal safety standards and legal requirements, and there were criminal charges brought forward. Amongst the 6 employees arrested was Yutaka Yokokawa, the 3rd worker, for negligence. He was the supervisor after all. At trial, the JCO president also pleaded guilty on behalf of the company, and it was found that the safety committee had approved the use of steel buckets during the procedure, even releasing a manual to this effect, telling workers to use this. They brought in these hazardous practices to speed up the process, even though it was well known to be dangerous. In response, special laws were put in place to ensure that this would never happen in Japan again, and quarterly inspections were required going forward. You would think that anything nuclear would have been subject to regular inspections anyway, but clearly that was not the case. Was this the fault of the men who died? No, it was the fault of the employers who knew the dangers that could come from shortcutting through the process, but money was ultimately more important than safety. In the aftermath, Japanese officials vowed that there would be renewed efforts to restore trust in the country's nuclear energy program, saying that they would redouble efforts to strengthen safety and disaster prevention measures. And to be fair, it does seem like this has happened. It also acted as a precautionary tale for plants dealing with nuclear energy all over the world. And hopefully something like this won't happen again. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.